Chapter 16, Installing a Gas Plant in the Guru's Ashram. Steve and Maria continued to research the making of methane gas plants in detail, buying up the few books that had been written about it. They also contacted a small company which made methane manure gas plants. They spoke with a representative of that company and revealed their plans. They explained that they wanted to start a plant by using the company's gas plant design and to learn from them how to adapt it to better suit their own venture. After a month or two, they bought their first test plant to install in the ashram and shipped it part by part to India where they would assemble it. The guru accompanied Steve and Maria to India at the time of the assembly to see how long they would prosper and to give them directives. During the long flight, they discussed philosophy and shared with the guru how they would install the equipment for the cow manure. They traveled by taxi to the main station where they took a train to the ashram town. Excited, Maria spoke to the guru of her friend Kathy, who had examined her birth certificate and found it lacking. "We keep in contact with her regularly. She is trying to find somebody, a group in my country or a detective or somebody, to discover whether there are some people who have the very names that are covered up on the birth certificate and whether they are my real parents. She hasn't found anyone trustworthy, but she is sure someone will pop up. Young people have secrets about life, and grown-ups have their secret values and truths, too. If my real parents are those people on the birth certificate who were crossed out, then they must have secrets. Tell me," she continued, "is there such a thing as a spiritual materialist? Isn't Mother Earth our primary mother, who we have to respect and spiritually aid? Isn't her secret the caring for Earth through the help of chosen individuals who can help those who lack or suffer? Maybe those detectives can help prove something and help substantiate the loving establishment of my family in its proper order, more in tune with the true nature of Earth." "This is the yin and yang," the guru answered. "Materialists are absolutists, and many spiritualists are absolutists. It defeats the purpose of the Godhead to say that transcendence of the material world is a spiritual absolute, as with the material absolutists who say that desire is our only drive. Both of these ideas are greedy and self-centered. An ashram centered around destruction of the material ego is a spiritually self-centered organization itself. It is a central, presupposed, limited idea, just as the materialistic community has one absolutist idea, the development of the ego, even to the exclusion of love. Take these seats, for example. We are comfortable here in second class, while many people sit in third class. We are spiritually comfortable. There are some perks to spirituality, so we should help the third class come to second class and help the first class perhaps come down to second class as well. A spiritually complete person many times doesn't want to save the spiritually lacking person, and the successful materialist doesn't want to help those who are illogical and impractical. God, as is known, hasn't reached many, many of his people. If a man was to reach out and save more people, like the Godhead has done with us, wouldn't that be godlike, or at least sanity or deity-like? I prefer to call God Godhead, as if God too has sacrificed, so that only God's head remains, like John the Baptist or like the heads on many of the Hindu deities, though most of them represent foes. The guru gestured toward the statue of Siva Nataraja that he had on top of his luggage. "You see here, Siva is stamping out the demon below his feet. Many people think he is stamping out the demon of the ego, but more so he is treading on the faults of the ego, just as this train crosses the earth below it. The deity stamps and treads on psychic chaos and on the confusion that comes from prior ways and ideals. It is trying to make sense of things, to do away with the past, but the emotional spirit is swayed by the ways of the ego. It is prejudiced and discriminatory, just like the ego. It bites its own tail, just as the mythical snake Ouroboros does. The ethereal transcendent self can be static and grossly unwieldy, just as this material train is when it stands inactive in its tracks. Even the transcendent self can be spiritless and lacking altruism, as if even the inspired intellect can be static because of coincidental spiritual ignorance. You must have an active spirit and ego to grab hold of a dynamic train of spiritual intellectual thought. This is the vehicle of the spirit and mind that is used to spread wisdom throughout the world and hopefully into the cosmos, much like physical vehicles spread materialism throughout the world." The train lurched and squealed into motion. Shortly, they reached the edge of town and were on their way across the Indian countryside. "Is spirituality limited? It seems limitless to me," Steve asked, awed by the unfamiliar scenery and people that surrounded him. He was awed by the guru and by the knowledge that he had finally found real direction in what was being accomplished through him. Just as the train approaches the city limits, spirituality too has limits. The spirit works in limited structure, even though it may seem limitless. As with the wheel of life, the heavens are limited by borders. The heavenly spirit is limited too. I believe in nirvana and the ability to escape the wheel, but I believe it also is a limited concept, wanting to run from the problems around you. Nirvana is everywhere, even in the most limiting thing we know of. To consider nirvana as a material ideal or a material model that imitates the heavenly is not necessarily bad. What is taken to heart is what is heavenly in itself, much like nirvana is thought to be innately heavenly. To cognitively define it in any way is putting it in a framework, but to fear palpable definition of nirvana is not unreasonable. Man will not escape completely from a framework of existence, spiritual or material. Even though I believe in moksha, or liberation from structure, God as we know him could live in a house or structure just as we do on earth, like the houses of astrology. The universe is his house, but he does not rule it completely. The devil or dark forces reside there as well. We must imitate God and try to create new houses just as we develop new governments and establishments and teach self-suffering. It says in the Bible, in God's kingdom there are many mansions. Inspired, Steve interrupted, "You've heard the song, The House of the Rising Sun, haven't you? Some people wake up to the light every morning in their houses only to sleepwalk through the day and begin the process of sin all over again. It is like their spiritual and mental faculties are asleep. While they are surrounded by the spirit, they are, and meanwhile, sensually attracted to things around them without caring or affection. They are unable to use proper insight to take things to heart. This makes them crawl on their stomachs all through the day, many times through no real fault of their own. Their kundalini is not awake," said the guru. "The consciousness where the snake is at the bottom of the spine has not crawled up to the mind and awakened to the brilliance there. Just as this train that bends, twists, and turns, sometimes meandering to its destination, it eventually arrives at the end of the line, the be-all and end-all of everything. As we hope, the answer lies at the end and will be forthcoming to all who search. With any luck, this is what we'll find at the end of our journey at the ashram. We will be awakened, ready to share the light with others, not rebelliously, but trying to reach all people, coalescing, not forcing beliefs on others." "You know," said Steve, "for a while we were attached to psychedelic substances for enlightenment. But isn't it true that drug use is called substance abuse? Isn't it a substance or a drug that you are attached to, separating yourself from the spirit that you'll do almost anything to get? Surely we don't fight over a substance to obtain true spirit. That's a contradiction." "Well said. I too tried drugs once or twice, but I knew if I didn't limit it to just those few times, I would be living in an imperfect world that would control me night and day," resonated the guru. "Drugs are a despotic way of spreading spirituality, only helping a small percentage of those who use it, ruining a large number of the other users. One never thinks you will be the one ruined." The conversation eventually drifted to an end. Steve and Maria were in all of their surroundings and bought tea from vendors at the stops, who passed their clay cups through the windows of the train to the customers within. They stopped and continued again and again, watching the beautiful scenery fly by. It was a mild ecstasy they experienced to ride the train. Within a few days after their arrival at the ashram, the parts they'd ordered for the manure gas plant were delivered. The company that sold the gas plant offered to assemble it for a price, but Steve got them to send a written assembly guide instead, for a more modest sum. Steve was mechanically inclined, and after studying the simple instructions, he knew it would be easy to put together. They took their time assembling it, and while they did, they attended a workshop at the ashram called Dream Games. It was a safer approach to altered states, utilizing spiritual dreams rather than going all out to achieve altered states of consciousness. Each group wrote down ideas to dream about that were then drawn from a hat. There were two different dream sessions. Steve was in one and Maria was in another. From the hat, Steve's group drew the topic, "Dreaming of Going to Heaven." Maria's group drew, "Why Does Life Seem a Lie or Accidental?" During the week, they conducted prone meditation, concentration, and relaxation sessions. They attempted to fade into a dream while the guide recited a story on one topic or the other. The guide then recited things that Maria would try to dream about. Is DNA an accident? Did God just haphazardly create the Garden of Eden? Is there real structure to life? Why did Adam and Eve lie about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Do we always have to lie about something? Do we have to perjure our lives, believing life is simple, innocent, and perfect, only to find ourselves falling into error? After about a week of trying and tired from assembling the manure plant and helping lay a brick frame for it, Maria finally and carefully faded into her group's dream topic. The first part of the dream was violent. She imagined herself as Joan of Arc burning at the stake. She could feel the flame singe her flesh, but she felt high. As she burned, she said, "I am dying to preserve the belief that life isn't a lie or an accident. It is my executioners who believe that life is a lie and an accident. But I came here for a reason. I am sacrificing my life to prove that life is not a lie." Watching the people gathered around the stake, she murmured, "I will be as a mother to you, and you people will remember me so. Whoever accepts contriteness without accepting defeat, I will save them from the lie and the accident." Then she dreamed that she was Marie Antoinette being led to the guillotine. She said, "I ruled as a child. I was a flower child who ruled half aware of the lies or accidents that involved normal life. I became a mother to France, accepting her children or people and whatever they do, just as long as they are responsible." She looked at the taunter straight in the eye and thought, "I knew you would kill me in my ego and deny my self-worth, but I will live on in people's hearts and I will be more than just a guilty little child. I will be a mother to you." At that second, her ego died and she was beheaded. She felt familiar with the Godhead, bodiless, very similar to what the Guru had described as to why he called God, Godhead. Maria then dreamed she and Steve visited the head of the Sufi cult. The Sufi leader said, "God is a lie and God is a creator of accidents. Come to me and I will prove that the whole world is based on a silly riddle and the only point of materiality is that of comedy and tragedy. There is no reasoning with man or God. We will worship the moon god that Abraham once worshipped." Maria preached to the Sufi, repeating her inner experiences as it related to what the Guru had said on the train. "I don't call God God. I call him the Godhead because I don't believe he is self-serving. What is truth in our minds is the Godhead. The Godhead is the sum of the self-sacrifice of humanity. The mothers of the world, through self-sacrifice, will become as the Godhead. Even those who are still controlled by life's lies and by the scepters and appearances that try to prove that life is an accident will be brought close to the mother of us all and through contriteness forgiven. There is good and bad in all things. In the primitive world of Abraham's time, the moon god represented the god of our time. We shouldn't denigrate primitive beliefs because they are primitive. And besides, the moon is beautiful. Leave us alone." She then dreamed that she stood with Steve before a judge. The judge said, "Why are you trying to predict your fate with these premonitions? If life is twilight and darkness, all you can predict is more darkness." He turned to Steve. "You did not accidentally smash that statue. You are an accident yourself, so all that you create is accidents." "Steve and I have witnessed the truth," Maria proclaimed. "I will be a mother to him and he'll be a father to me. Instead of allowing chaos to decide our fate, we are going to be predictable people and self-predict our lives. We will not allow the whims of the deities of chaos and malady to predict our lives." "Damn," said the judge, "you know that my real name is Chaos and my wife's name is Malady." Maria then saw a white light. Within the light appeared the vision of a woman like Mother Mary, but more hip. She spread her arms wide and said, "Don't perjure your beliefs anymore. I know it is an innocent thing being a flower child. Come to me and be a mother who nurtures predictability." Maria then woke up. She was a little frightened, but was happy she had reached God through her dreams, rather than through an artificially imposed altered state. It seemed much more tame and predictable this way. The guide asked how she felt, and she muttered blissfully in her Spanish mother-child voice, "I don't feel like I have perjured principles about things I believe in like I used to feel. I feel self-justified. I reached a mystical state through dreams, rather than shocking my mind into a half-awake trauma, trying to experience an altered state." The next day, Steve announced that his dream was successful, too. "For a while, I couldn't dream as the guide recited the sequences, nor remember them in detail. When I was young, I couldn't hardly remember my dreams at all, but I've gotten better. Finally, I had a vivid dream where I was in a foggy and mysterious place, much like the Tenderloin in San Francisco, only cleaned up. It wasn't lit directly. It seemed like a lower heaven, or maybe a mild purgatory. People's emotions were muted, even their emotions about religion. There was very little food, though once I saw someone drinking a golden liquid. When I looked at him, he quickly hid it as if it was forbidden and he would get in trouble if caught. It made me think of that set of cups I stole from my parents. I started down this path with another person toward a small church. I asked if it was all right to believe in the Buddha or in enlightenment in this place I was in. He said there was some censorship and nothing was forbidden. He said it was because truth was hidden and you had to search for it no matter where it came from. He said I was lucky to be able to go to this church because some saints and famous people sometimes travel to this humble place, and that Saint Francis of Assisi was at the church that day. Later in the fog and twilight, I heard Saint Francis speak about the transference of enlightenment. It was extremely real, but like a waking dream. When I first became aware of being in that heaven, I dreamt that I rolled over the floor into heaven. It was so real, I wonder whether my soul hadn't actually floated into heaven or into a beautiful, subdued purgatory. If that was really a purgatory, I don't mind. I would gladly live there, no matter how weird it was. In the dream, I could barely talk and spent hours, it seemed, trying to say something. You know, I have tried other techniques to have visions, but this is much safer. Not totally safe, but for a mind that doesn't have to force itself to dream, fairly safe. If you force yourself to dream, I think that could be dangerous. They both were in awe and slightly stupefied that they could achieve such amazing dream states. Being able to share with each other so well, they felt as if they were two blossoming flower child prophets in love. They had found actualization and the Godhead. A couple weeks later, they finished assembling the manure gas plant and it started to produce methane. When they had begun their project, they had been smart enough to ask the small company that produced these plants if the company could design a portable tank that would store a small amount of methane gas from the plant attached to a pump that pumped the gas into it. They also wanted the company to find a very simple gas stove design that would operate on the methane. The company did just that. The purpose was to see if the rural people near the ashram could afford the system to transport cheap methane from the ashram for inexpensive gas stove cooking. What the people in the area had used up to this point was burned cow and camel dung for cooking, which is very unsanitary. They also devised a plant for the local farms to buy extremely cheap fertilizer from the ashram, made from the slurry produced by the manure gas plant after the methane had been extracted from it. All this extra equipment arrived after the main supplies arrived. In an effort to spark the interest of the local Hindis, Steve and Maria went into one of the nearby villages to give away a few sample methane tanks, pumps, and stoves. While they set up a stove to cook some food with the family, the guru approached them. He was accompanied by a man from the small outlying village. Here is another meditator who often comes to the ashram. He works for the local government, the guru said. He wants to get funding for manure gas plants for large and small operations that are half private and half subsidized by government. He believes it will be an economically sound endeavor and inexpensive enough for even the poorest to afford. That's fantastic, said Steve, thinking fast. If we could start a private company with the government to develop manure gas in India and have it partially paid for by taxes, we could develop twice as fast. If the populace pays for most of its natural gas by donating manure, we could give it away almost for free. We could put up enough methane gas plants for hundreds of thousands of people in a short time. Some of the profit could go to other ecological government projects. We could capitalize, but only to create ecologically sounder businesses for the world. It isn't corrupt at all. Many private firms are hired to run governmental projects, such as the mental health system in America. They have private mental health programs doing a lot of the work the government would rather avoid. The other man said in a thick musical Indian accent, I am trying to work with this system we have to change the government on its own terms in order to avoid social revolution. I have mentioned this to a few of my colleagues and they seem interested. I have been told that these plants are simple to build and inexpensive to maintain. Maria said, I don't think we want to be a typical nonprofit, but we do want to be very, very affordable to the poor. The money wouldn't go towards pleasure, really. It would go towards development. The Hindu who was cooking the food offered them some spicy lentils to eat. They all started eating. As he ate his lentils, the meditator said, Obviously, this stove works well. I think it will make a good impression upon the government. It will clean up the problem of the poor cooking with germ-ridden cow and camel dung. The manure plant was so successful at the ashram that Steve and Maria found it easy to organize a small company to create manure gas plants as a practical experiment for giving India power from manure gas. They were written up in the newspapers and listed in the news as the folk rock band who'd made it good. They received help from webmasters who created a website for them that described all their successful endeavors toward practical, peaceful revolution. In a statement on the website, Steve asserted that they were both, in part, kids without real families, that he and Maria had been nurturing each other. He revealed that he had often wondered whether his parents were his true parents, they being so different from him. Because he had felt this, Maria had begun to wonder the same thing.